Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Wherever you may stand on the issues before this just-ended session of the Missouri Legislature, there was something for everybody. A little less for Democrats in the Republican-dominated General Assembly, perhaps, but a lot of business was taken care of. Taxes, education, gun issues among them, and a number of issues to be decided by voters in November. I'm Don Marsh. With me in studio to talk about the legislative session and its fallout, Terry Jones is the founder's professor of political science and public policy administration at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. From St. Louis Public Radio, political reporter Joe Manis, Marshall Griffin, Capitol correspondent, and education reporter Dale Singer. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for
having us. Thank you.
Y'all catch up on your sleep over the weekend?
Oh, right.
Well, good to have you with us. And let's get the discussion started with Terry. And I'll ask everyone pretty much the same question. Just give me, in very general terms, Terry, your take on the session just ended.
Well, Rex Singfield, the wealthy donor, has contributed so much, millions of dollars, to candidates, finally got a major return on his investment. At the top of his policy agenda is a reduced reliance by the state on income taxes, and a bill that passed last session in the 2013 but was vetoed by the governor, not overrode, in the 2013, did pass and was vetoed again but was overridden. And that means that the state is going to have much less reliance on income taxes over the next 6 to 8 years. And when the provisions are fully in effect, that's going to be $600 to $700 million less coming from income taxes into the state treasury.
A state treasury that needs more funds, needless to say.
Well, it doubles down on the economic development philosophy that low tax, low service is the way to increase the number of jobs in the state. It's a dubious proposition, but it's one that's public policy in Missouri.
Dale Singer, let me turn to you.
Well, the big story, and as far as education goes, of course, was the student transfer bill. It's just to give you an idea of what happened, the law that authorized the student transfers back from 1993 was two paragraphs. The bill that was passed last week by the legislature is 135 pages. So you have an idea that sometimes when the legislators get together, they figure they better put something in there for everybody to like so they'll want to vote for it, but it's very, very complicated. When the students started leaving Normandy and Riverview Gardens last year and everybody got up in arms, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? This is the answer, but it goes far beyond just student transfers.
We'll see if more is better as this thing unfolds.
Right.
All right. Marshall Griffin, what's your take on the just-ended session?
Well, the Republicans continue to have their way on a lot of issues, but they had to do a little bit of horse trading to at least advance two of their priorities. Specifically in the Senate on Monday night, there was two things that were blocked in particular they wanted moved forward, and that was the 72-hour waiting period for abortions and also the early voting bill that they passed basically would trump the Citizens Initiative as far as that's also out there waiting to be voted on. In order to get those things advanced, they had to give up their paycheck protection bill, and they also had to give up the photo ID measure that they had been pushing. So a little bit of horse trading had to go on. It was overall a good session for the Republicans as they were able to override the governor's veto on the tax cut. They did give up a few things, and I'll let Joe elaborate a little bit on what the governor had to say Friday, as she was there for his final press avail, and he was not happy.
Yeah, I just want to point out that you're talking about right to work, as it's commonly known with regard to that.
Well, actually, paycheck protection is a different bill.
Yes, but it's part of the right to work platform, but this was some call a chink or a first level in the platform.
Yeah. That's why we bring the experts in. Yeah. So I don't have to talk about it. Go ahead, Joe. The governor was irate, I would say.
Yes, it was a very polarized session, and one of the interesting things at the governor's news conference was that you got a glimpse of the old Nixon about 25 years ago, the hothead. He was mad, and in fact, the light shining on where he was standing gave him an extra red glow. So all the photos had sort of a red glow, which was sort of reflected in his anger. He zeroed in not on some of this other stuff, but on what had happened during the last day, amid all the focus on guns and some of the other things, was that the legislators approved a whole bunch of small bills, in most cases, that had tax breaks in them. So the result was that over the course of one day, they approved measures that would take about $500 million out of the state's budget every year for tax breaks. So he's like, okay, on the one hand, you guys just overrode me on a tax cut. When it's put into effect, we're going to lose $600 or $700 million. By your count, he claims it could be higher. And then you add all these tax breaks. And so his view was that you guys are being irresponsible. I, the responsible person, although he didn't use those words, but he implied it, I'm going to have to straighten all this up, and I'm going to have to do all this vetoing and withholding. Now, the backdrop of this is that one of the measures that the legislature approved the last couple days was a proposed constitutional amendment to actually that will be on the ballot this fall that would reduce the governor's power to do just that. So we asked him whether or not he's going to be campaigning about that, and he sort of sidestepped it. But I think that he was definitely trying to portray the legislature as being irresponsible and talking one thing and then doing another. And, of course, they've been after him, saying that he had not been that engaged in the General Assembly. And even some Democrats had complained about that, that he hadn't been engaged in particular stuff. He defended himself a little bit about that, but he zeroed in on this budget stuff. In fact, he had his budget staff put out a detailed list of every one of these tax breaks. So he definitely was trying to shift the conversation away from guns, transfers, and some of this other stuff, although he said he would deal with it to talk about this. So I think he definitely was much more aggressive than he'd been lately in going after the Republicans running the General Assembly.
Of course, he's not running again.
Right, he can't. But the conventional wisdom, which we've talked about before, is that he possibly, although he's never said, is probably hoping to get some sort of presidential cabinet position if Hillary Clinton, who he's already endorsed, becomes the next president. Or some have said, because, and I have said this, he's one of the few Democrats who are the right age, who are a governor from a Midwest state. And those are prize commodity, and the Democrats are going to need one if they end up nominating somebody from one of the coasts to head the ticket. So I think he's going to be on some vice presidential shortlists, and this is the type of thing to bolster his aura.
While we're on that, let me turn back to Terry Jones, the political scientist among us. How does that look to you, Jay Nixon's political future?
Well, he's certainly not going to retire from public life. That's not the Jay Nixon that I know or that I suspect any one of us around the table. So the only question is, what role is he going to seek to play in public life? And I quite agree with Joe. The first option, I think, is going to be some role in a possible Clinton administration if Hillary Clinton is elected in 2016.
Marshall, what are they talking about in the halls of the legislature?
Well, right now, the hall, literally speaking, the halls are very deserted.
But, well, you're here, among other things.
That's true. I actually am here for my first in-person show here. But the talk, as things winded down Friday, the talk was, how soon might we be coming back to Jefferson City? It's the student transfer bill, which got sent to the governor. There's already been talk, and there's already been lawmakers from both parties saying, okay, governor, you don't like this bill. But if you're going to veto it as soon as possible so that we can come back here and pass something else during a special session that you won't veto. That's the general message that's being sounded by lawmakers from both parties. And it, so far, no word yet on how soon the governor plans to act on the student transfer bill.
Wouldn't it work in his best interest to let this thing drag out for a while so that he can do a little lobbying of his own?
Possibly, but he also there's also, I suppose, the possibility that if he lets it drag on too long and they don't have time to get something in place before the start of the school year, that could cause some complications for some local school districts.
Dale Singer, what is the governor's problem with the transfer bill?
His main problem is one provision that would allow student transfers to non-sectarian private schools. It's very limited at this point. It would have to be approved by local school boards. It could only be paid for. The tuition to the private schools could only be paid for by money that's raised locally as opposed to state funds. And the private schools that agree to accept transfer students would also have to agree to give state tests and some other state oversight that I've talked with private school headmasters who say, no, we don't want any state money because we don't want any state strings attached. So at this point, there's only one private school, non-sectarian private school, that would fit the definition of the bill. That's a school in the Riverview Gardens district. But that is what that is where he says he'll draw the line. That is where he says he does not he calls it a voucher bill. Other people say, well, no, it's not a voucher bill. There's something called the Blaine Amendment in the state constitution that does not allow for public money to be used this way. But supporters of this say, well, it's not state money. It's local money, and a local district, voters in a local district would have to approve its use, so it's okay. But going back to what Joe was saying about his being engaged, when people who were in favor of this option, the so-called private option, were talking about the bill last week, you know, basically they said, well, you know, you don't like it, Governor, where have you been? We've been working on this for a long time. Just as they say he was not engaged in some of the budgetary things or some of the other things, they say he has not really been all that active in coming up with a plan from the governor's office to solve the transfer problem that would be acceptable.
Terry, is it a voucher bill?
Yes, this is more about principle and symbolic politics than it is about actual what would happen, because all of the limitations on the possibility of using a voucher under the legislation that just passed and the governor may or may not veto makes it would not happen. And on the other hand, again, we're back to Rex Singfield, for whom school choice is also high on his policy agenda list and who has been championing that cause and funding people who do it on his behalf. This does establish the principle within state law and gives them a floor on which to build if you wanted to expand school choice.
Right. Will there be a special session, do you think, Joe, on this?
I bet there probably will be, but I think the governor is going to let people sit and think about it for a while. I mean, now he's contending, just to do a little pushback, he's contending that actually he had been talking to people over the course. And he also had put out pretty much his ideas and his plans in a State of the State address at the end of January. It's just that the General Assembly pretty much ignored all of it. And then he also has been trying to walk this fine line. He doesn't want to become a Bob Holden, who was the last Democratic governor before him, who tried to be engaged with the Republican-controlled General Assembly, and they basically spent 4 years slapping him around. So I think the governor has been trying to, fair or unfair, has been trying to let – I think he has seen it that it works better for him – if he lets the General Assembly act, and then he comes around and says, how stupid can you be?
And as far as the timing goes, I want to reinforce what Marshall said, that you know, when you've got parents, you've got students, you've got a lot of people wondering where they're going to go to school in the fall. You don't even know whether there's going to be a Normandy school district. So to let this go on until a fall veto session as opposed to a special session would just increase that uncertainty.
One of the things that I've read, Joe, and it may have been one of your pieces or perhaps Dale's, is the fact that in order for there to really to be a special session, there has to be a deal pretty much made beforehand.
Exactly, because it does cost the state money, or i.e. the taxpayers money, when you have a special session, especially if you have it separately during the summer as opposed to doing it concurrently with a veto session where you just extended a few
days.
Which
they just did.
Right, in September. But as we saw a few years ago when they thought there was a deal on tax credits, if you recall, going back a few years, and they had a special session, this ended up going on for almost a month. And what came out of it? Nothing. So I think, except, you know, legislators got more reimbursements and the tax bill was bigger. So the governor has made it very clear that before he calls something, there has to be a deal cut. And that's not always easy to get. If you recall, when we were talking about this 6-8 months ago, we had a bunch of state senators, Republican and Democrat, from the St. Louis area who had been working for months on a deal, thought they had a package together that would be able to sail through the legislature because it was bipartisan and all this and that. Where'd that go? You know, nowhere.
Yeah. A number of senators who said, wait a minute, I wasn't a part of this deal. I'm not going to let this go. And that's pretty much what happened. You know?
Right. We have to take a break. We'll do that now. We're talking about the just concluded session of the Missouri State Legislature. My guests in studio are Joe Manis of St. Louis Public Radio, Dale Singer of St. Louis Public Radio, Marshall Griffin of St. Louis Public Radio, and Terry Jones.
Who
I don't want to say odd man out, but Terry is the odd man out with this panel in a sense, in a manner. manner of speaking. We'll come back. Continue the conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get in on it, we'd love to hear from you. What pleases or displeases you about the just-concluded session? This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation on the just-concluded Missouri legislative session, but first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The ride-sharing app Lyft is making its case in court today on why the company should be allowed to do business in St. Louis. The city's taxicab commission says the company isn't following taxi rules and is competing with an unfair advantage. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon and St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley will attend a groundbreaking this afternoon for a $45 million expansion of the Danforth Plant Science Center Research Building. And Illinois Governor Pat Quinn is expected to attend the House Democrats Caucus meeting to make a pitch to support an extension of the state's temporary income tax increase. Quinn is locked in a battle for re-election with Republican businessman Bruce Runner in the nation's most watched governor's races. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day at our website at stlpublicradio.org. Back to our conversation now with Joe Manis, Terry Jones, Dale Singer, and Marshall Griffin on the just-concluded legislative session. And before we move on to some of the specific things that were dealt with, Joe, you had indicated during the break that politics is certainly a big part of everything that's been going on.
Yes, and my point was it's not just what's Jay Nixon going to be doing. A lot of it's about what's House Speaker Tim Jones going to be doing in 2 years. What is Senate President Pro Tem Tom Dempsey going to be doing in 2 years? He set up a campaign committee to run for statewide office. Dempsey hasn't said. Jones is widely believed to probably be running for attorney general in 2 years. You've got at least two state senators, others who are talking about running for attorney general as well. These are all Republicans. And there's a number of Republicans in the House that are running for the Senate. So the point being is that on a lot of the legislators' minds, they're not thinking about what the governor is going to be doing. They're thinking about what am I going to be doing? What is the leader of my party going to be doing? And some of this played into arguably the gun bill, the approval of the gun bill, and some of the other issues that Republicans really wanted to get through so they could show their base that they could be effective in pushing some of these key issues to the base.
One of the consequences, Don, of Missouri having term limits is that the action in the General Assembly is now driven so much by what office, what members are seeking next, and that explains so much more of their behavior than it did before term limits were in existence.
Right. Marshall, revising of the state's criminal code was a big part of this legislative session. The governor didn't sign it and allowed it to become law without his signature. Why did he do that?
Because of the problems that he had with some of the provisions. In particular, there was one area that had to do with DWI laws, where it could be interpreted that if you refuse to take a blood alcohol test, that would be inadmissible in court unless you were under the age of 21. There were some lawmakers said, well, no, that's not exactly what it will do. But if the governor wants us to tweak it a bit and rewrite it a little bit so that it's explained better, and if that's the price we got to pay to get it passed, then we'll do that. So that was done. Also, some language regarding the bulk purchases of pseudoephedrine. There were some concerns about how that was written. So the governor basically said, okay, if you will make these corrections that I want, I will allow this bill to become law without my signature. And when you do the corrections that I want, send that bill to me. And the assumption is that he will sign that one.
Is that likely to happen?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, they gave him what he wanted. They gave him what he asked for. I would assume that he would actually sign that. So.
Dale, tick off. Education was a big part of the session, and the transfer issue was certainly a big one. What are some of the other things relating to education that the legislature dealt with?
They funded preschool, which has always been a very, very high priority for educators. Educators say constantly, no matter where you, what meetings you go to or who you talk to, that quality preschool, getting kids ready to learn starting at age three, is one of the biggest factors that you can count on to improve their performance later on in school. And this has been something that I think Senator Cavaney from St. Louis and others have been pushing for a long time. That finally got through.
And this was considered an example of supreme bipartisanship.
I guess. Common Core has also been a some couple of fighting words that that people have been bringing up. Common Core state standards have been adopted by Missouri and more than 40 other states nationwide. They're standards that were put together by a group of coming out of the National Governors Conference. And they're basically a bunch of standards saying not what you should do, but what you should know, and leaving up to local, leaving up to states, and leaving up to local school districts how you get there. Opponents in the legislature, this is a kind of a national movement from ALEC and some of the other conservative groups, but also people on the left as well have had complaints about this. They say people on the right say it's federally mandated. It's coming down from the top. People on the left say it involves too much testing. So there have been complaints about it one way or the other. A bill that passed basically says Missouri has to start over. They can't take the Common Core state standards that they've already approved. They have to go ahead and draw up their own Missouri standards, which has also happened in Indiana, which is the only other only state so far that has repudiated. But guess what? When the new Indiana standards came out, they looked an awful lot like the Common Core state standards.
You mentioned ALEC. Just tell our audience briefly what ALEC is all about.
What does ALEC stand for?
American Legislative Exchange.
Okay, thank you. I knew I could count this on this table. ALEC is a lobbying group?
It's a conservative group that
champions various causes in various states, and they often people will say, "Oh, gee, ALEC wanted that. I didn't know that. I came up with that on my own." But
they're often portrayed as puppet masters by their political opponents. So.
They actually write a lot of legislation.
Contend that they're not a lobbying group; that they're basically an education group, and that there's a lot of legislators who are members in Missouri. There's close to 50. Who are considered members of ALEC.
I want to go to the phones, but Terry, I just wanted to point out with regard to education, they have tied funding for higher education to performance. As an educator, what do you think of that?
I think it's a good move by and large, and in doing so, they consulted significantly with leaders in higher education so that they were not imposed without that consultation. So there's widespread acceptance among the colleges and universities in the state that those are legitimate and reasonable standards for the state to set.
And wasn't the coordinating board also doing that to a certain extent already?
Already, but this is the closest tie there's been to actual dollars if you do this. And the size and amount of the dollars are larger.
And some dollars are coming in for capital improvements, I think, as well.
Yes, although there's still a significant burden or obligation placed upon the campus that is proposing a building to raise privately a significant share of the money for that building.
Well, the state's standing to lose $1 billion. I guess they're going to have to do that a lot, right? Let's go to the phones. Other issues, major issues to talk about, but let's get the audience into the conversation. We'll start with Gary calling from O'Fallon. Is it Gary?
Jerry.
Okay. Go ahead, Jerry. I think it's our Jerry, right? The one we talk to a lot. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. First of all, I want to say that this is probably the most comprehensive coverage of our state government that you regularly produce for us, and I thank you for that. It's people just don't pay attention a lot of times to local and state issues, and that can have probably the greatest impact on their day-to-day lives. I guess my point is, I just heard this morning former Senator Jim Webb talk about the one of what he sees as an issue is that we're taxing both earned income and other forms of regressive tax have outpaced our will to tax higher incomes. And, you know, the tax breaks that were mentioned at the very beginning of the show that were passed, you know, if people take a close look at them, they are going to fall more heavily on the working class and poorer, lower-income people of the state, to essentially subsidize the people who, as the aforementioned sponsor of the bill, not sponsored technically, but you know, those who are better off. And I guess the other point is that, you know, following Kansas and some of these other low-service, low-tax states, what we see is, in essence, they truly are red states because they will now have to have more funding from the federal government. And to me, that whole conservative it's kind of a fallacy that, you know, we're low tax, low benefit, but the benefits will come from somewhere, and it's going to be, you know, paid for through our shared by the rest of the country.
Jerry, thank you so much for the call. Someone here like to respond to? Go ahead, Terry.
Well, the tax system will become more regressive or less progressive with the implementation of the income tax reductions over the next 6 to 8 years. And if the voters pass the sales tax for transportation in November, that will increase the regressivity of the tax system in Missouri.
You know, the voters are going to have a lot of work to do in September. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't recall a period where we're putting five potential constitutional amendments on the ballot at the same time.
Yes. This could be one of the more crowded years for issues. And because State Auditor Tom Schweik, who's running for reelection, really doesn't have any major opponent, most of the focus is going to be on issues. You've got at least four or five that are probably going to make the ballot. There may be some court challenges or that sort of thing. But then in addition, you've got several initiative petitions. You've got these dueling ones. You've got initiative petition to allow for early voting, which would allow it for about 6 weeks, and including some nights and weekends.
6 weeks or 6 days?
6 weeks.
Six. Okay.
Then you've got the one that the legislature approved, which is just for 6 days, which would only be it would only add regular business hours. There would be no nights and weekends. Mm-hmm. Now, the legislative one states in there that if we pass, we're the one, even if they get less votes than the other one. Currently, the state constitution says if you have two issues on the ballot, same issue, the one with the most votes wins. So the General Assembly's tried to get around it by putting in there is that we're the top dog. So there will probably be some court fights over this potentially. So in other words, you could have – right now it looks like we'll probably have six or seven issues, major issues on the ballot. And that's aside from any local ones that people put on.
Is this an attempt in the cases that were passed and approved by the legislature to bypass the governor?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because the governor has no role in putting something on the ballot. So the House and Senate, just like they're going to have this thing that curbs the governor's power to do withholds and to restrict spending, they can do that thing, putting him on the ballot, because the governor's signature is not involved.
So politics at work once again. But it's the state legislature. Why shouldn't we expect politics to be involved? Let's go back to the phones and bring in John, calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, John.
Hi. My question is about House Bill 1557. I live in Bonita Park, and this bill is about automated speed enforcement and red light cameras and allowing camera enforcement. And the thing is that I walk across Page Avenue, and I dodge speeders like a bad game of Frogger almost every night when I get off the bus. And when they put those cameras in, it made the roads safer. And for the first time in years, I feel like I can actually cross my street and not worry. And I went up to my city hall, and they said that they're not going to do anything about it till 1557 passes. And it didn't pass, so they're not. I don't know if they're going to be turning the cameras back on or not. And now we talk about the sales tax increase, and these cameras can really help make people who break the laws on the road pay for road improvements. Also, in terms of the private part of the education, I just have a cousin who just graduated from something that they called a credit recovery program, and it was called ACE Learning Centers, and as far as I know, that fits exactly what the privatization part of the transfer bill talked about. I'll take my answer off the air, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, let's start first with the red light cameras. You don't often run into people who are so supportive of red light cameras.
Well, one of the fascinating things about the fun things occurring at General Assembly, I know a lot of the lobbyists, because some of them are former legislators, but also former whatever, and so they're always wandering the halls policing their certain things. Well, several of them who I know were on the red light camera crew, and they're basically was trying to make sure that nothing happened. And so nothing happened. Although at the end, like one of the last five or ten bills in the House, somebody brought up something to try to regulate red light cameras, and there was some debate, and then all of a sudden it was just killed. And it was obviously deals cut out in the hall.
I was in the room when it was received its fatal wound in the Senate, I guess you could say. You know, the initial bill would have basically just said no points for traffic violations that were cited by red light cameras. And then Senator Lager introduced an amendment that would ban all red light cameras in Missouri, and that's when the bill got laid aside and we never saw it again.
Right.
Okay. Any other comments with regard to that? One other issue that we have to talk about before we take the next break is Medicaid expansion. This was something that everybody was talking about prior to the session. Marshall, didn't happen.
Didn't happen. We kept hearing in the hallways that, we're actually close. Something might actually come about this year. You had former Senator and former Governor Kit Bond pushing for what was called a Missouri solution, which would basically tie some reforms into expanding Medicaid. And when they were out selling this, they were actually calling it reform. They were trying to steer clear of the word expansion to, I guess, make it a little bit more palatable. But it still didn't get done. The Republicans on both the Republican leaders in both the House and the Senate still shot down every expansion attempt and a proposal, even from within their own party. The Midway or alternate plan that was being proposed by Senator Ryan Silvey and by State Representative Noel Torpy.
I don't think anything demonstrates the increasing polarization in the state of Missouri than the Medicaid expansion. Because even though normal Republican interests like business were four square foot behind it, icons like Kit Bond was working hard to make it happen, the opposition to anything associated with President Obama is so intense among so many Republicans, it's rejected on that point alone.
And it's the free money issue that a lot of people just shake their head. The state stands to lose hundreds of millions of dollars.
$2 billion a year.
It probably didn't help that this is an election year as well, and some of those Republicans said, how am I going to win my next race or get reelected if I vote for even a limited Medicaid expansion?
Now, one of the reasons there was some of this last-minute shifting was because in Indiana, the Republican governor, Mike Pence, who's on a lot of short lists as a potential presidential candidate, has crafted a way to come up with a Indiana solution which allows them to take the money and it doesn't necessarily isn't called expansion. I'm just using that as an example because there are some other states similarly that are Republican run by Republican governors and who they're trying to come up with something so they can get the money and not call it expansion. So you had some legislators and Kit Bond and some others who were saying, look, this is a way for us to do this. And with the Missouri Chamber really pressing really hard for them to come up with something so they could take the money. Because this one of the proposals that the governor came up with at the end, and some thought he should have come up with it at the beginning, was under his last-minute proposal, was that the money would go directly to small businesses to subsidize them covering the insurance for their lower-income workers. And you had some of the Republican leaders saying, well, if you'd proposed that 4 or 5 months ago, maybe we might have gone for it. So that the bottom line is Missouri isn't in it, and unless the federal law has changed, Missouri missed the first year of the 3 years of, quote, free money. So even if Missouri does it later, they're still out this $2 billion that they would have gotten for 2014.
Opponents are concerned that at the end of 3 years, the state would have to foot the bill, and that's the problem, right?
Well, part of it's that, although under the law, the federal government would cover at least 90% thereafter. It phases in, but the federal government covers 90%. You've got some Republicans who believe that, A, the federal government doesn't have the money and that it'll eventually renege on the promise. But then you also have the philosophical argument that many Republicans don't believe that the federal government should be that involved in health care, period. That they believe that the better way is to do more free market solutions. And so they didn't want to approve anything that would encourage the federal government's expansion in healthcare, because the belief is once it's expanded, you're not going to be able to contract it.
Yeah. Dale, I know you want to comment, but give me a chance to take this break. I've got to
go ahead
before we get too far behind, and we'll come back with your comment on Medicaid expansion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back as we continue our conversation on the fallout from the legislative session here in Missouri just ended last Friday. With me in studio from St. Louis Public Radio, Joe Manis, Marshall Griffin, and Dale Singer, and from the University of Missouri St. Louis, Professor Terry Jones. Dale, back to you. Sorry, I had to interrupt your
thought.
That's
okay. There. It wasn't so much on Medicaid expansion. I just wanted to play off of what Terry was saying, that one of the reasons people are against a lot of things is if it's associated with President Obama. If Obama likes it, I don't like it. And in the Common Core area, the people have started calling the Common Core standards Obama Core because they that kind of rallies that kind of bedrock opposition.
You know, that does seem to work, too. I think of the Affordable Care Act. When people are asked and polled on the Affordable Care Act, they seem to like it all right. But when they call it Obamacare, they don't like it at all. It's just inserting that name
right.
There really seems to do the job. Let's go back to the phones, bring in Richard, caller from St. Louis. Richard, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I had a question on the status of the Missouri voter ID movement or legislation. And the point was, there was a very critical article in the Wall Street Journal about voter ID, and what the writer, Mr. Joseph Popper, a lawyer, said is that in the case of California, it appears that there are about 2.5 million people who are registered in other states in addition to being registered in California. And I wonder if your panel would comment on the Missouri situation and whether there's a check on preventing this double registration for the upcoming elections. Thank you.
Marshall, do you want to take that?
Well, I will tell you this. There's been a lot of concerns raised by those who are pushing the photo voter ID that there is impersonation going on or double registration going on, and that's the whole purpose why it's needed. But the actual documented cases, I can't answer to that.
Terry, you can.
Those double registration figures are grossly inflated. When people move from one state to another, you don't deregister when you move, but you never exercise your right to vote in the state that you came from, or if you move within a county or between counties within a state. So you can look at the records and see that same name there twice, but did somebody actually vote in the same election in two different jurisdictions? That's minuscule, the number of situations like that.
That's right, Joe. It's really not a big issue.
Yeah, there was one or two in recent years where people were voting in Illinois and Missouri, for example, but that's out of millions cast. And there have been some critics of the photo ID restriction because we want to emphasize, in Missouri, you do have to have ID. It's just not a photo ID. And some of the opponents of the photo ID have said, well, that wouldn't correct any of this, that this has to do more with the cleaning of the electronic rolls and having some sort of nationwide database so that it would be easier for the Secretary of State of the different states to follow this. So if somebody is now voting in Missouri, let's say, and they used to live in Illinois, but they're still in the Illinois rolls, even though they don't vote there, that there's a way to clear it off. Now, under the federal law, you have to not vote in two major elections before they can even start to clear you off. So that's one of the reasons you do see these inflated numbers on the rolls.
What is a major election? And what would qualify?
Well, it would be a national election. So in other words, it'd have to be a congressional or a presidential election. So in other words, it's 4 or 6 years before they can take your name off.
Oh, okay. Back to the phone. Scott in Chesterfield, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah. If somebody impersonates me at the polls, I think when I go to vote, they're going to get caught. But, you know, on the Missouri legislature, they just voted a tax cut to put a hole in the budget that they think is going to be filled by some kind of magical voodoo economics. And, you know, I mean, these guys, and then they backed up. They said, okay, we won't put federal agents in jail for, you know, doing their job on firearms. We'll just let the criminals sue them. So, you know, I mean, these guys they're ignorant. The people running the Missouri legislature are ignorant, and they make Missouri look ignorant. So, you know, how long are the Missouri voters going to put up with this?
Well, we shall see. Thanks very much for the call. Don't forget that this is the same legislature, though, that did make jumping jacks the official state exercise. So
that's true.
they were busy on other things as well. He mentioned the gun nullification law, basically dealing with the federal firearms policy. That did not pass. But there were some other gun issues, Marshall, that did.
I believe there was one that regarded the concealed carry consent age, I believe, was lowered to 19. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That was that
From 21.
And that's the one that also had the provision that will allow school districts to arm teachers and administrators. And that one also has a provision that bars healthcare professionals from identifying someone as far as being a gun owner. So in other words, like let's say if you're picked up and they believe you have a mental problem and you're put in a medical facility for a while, they're not allowed to tell others that they believe that you have gun permit. There's several. That particular bill has quite a few provisions like that, although most of the publicity has been over the it also bars – it allows people with concealed carry permits to carry their guns openly, and it bars communities from banning that practice.
So shades of the Old West, Terry Jones. I mean, you just strap it on your side and go where you've got to go.
Well, it creates also a real dilemma for institutions of education that want to go the other way and to keep firearms off campus. And so that conflict between what individual school districts and universities want to do and what now state law says you can do will be have to be worked out.
And let me throw in as well that those provisions, a lot of those provisions were also in the Gun Control Nullification Bill or the Second Amendment Preservation Act, the official name of the bill. But perhaps shifting it to this other bill, they were hedging their bets that it might these other things might actually have a better chance of making it if it's not tied to this controversial bill. And I'll throw one quick thing in. The final hour of the legislative session, there was a really amazing way that this bill did not make it. There was differences of opinion as to whether or not federal agents should be either charged with a misdemeanor or just liable to be sued in court. They came to a decision, picked the liability, passed it in the House, sent it over to the Senate, and when the last 20 minutes of the session was spent by Senator Jolie Justice filibustering that bill and killing it as her final act as a state senator.
Yeah, and this was a rare case because, see, it started in the House. This just came up in the last hour where the gun nullification bill, which everybody said was dead, all of a sudden was resurrected. The Democrats in the House, who rarely, because they're so outnumbered, do any sort of filibustering, they actually did, and they were allowed to do so for a good 20, 30 minutes. Well, then finally the vote was ordered. So just as Marshall said, so by the time it went to the Senate, there was only 20 minutes left. So then the belief was, and that's what happened, is that the Democrats in the Senate would kill it. That's what they did.
Dale, and you're reporting on education. Have you met any teachers who are really happy to have the ability to carry a weapon?
No, I know. My wife taught for a long time, and the last thing in the world she would want to have to worry about is something like that. Teachers have enough to do right now without having to worry about whether they should be packing heat.
Terry, you are
I believe
a teacher.
The pen is not only mightier than the sword, but also mightier than a Colt 45.
Right. Well, I did some work in law enforcement before coming over here, and I can tell you if there's an active shooter in a school or any place else, and the police come in and a teacher happens to be holding a gun to protect students from the active shooter, that teacher's like to get blown away. Let's go back to the phones. Jay in Normandy, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm so happy that the gun nullification bill did not pass, and I'm a law enforcement person. But I'm hopeful that the other bills that you just talked about, this teacher carry and any other gun-related, I'm a little confused. Is there a constitutional amendment about hunting now and guns? So I'd like to know about that. Is there something that the voters are going to have to vote on? But I'm hopeful that Governor Nixon will veto this teacher carry. And one other question, last question. Also, the gun nullification bill had that crazy open carry in it. I'm wondering if that also hopefully is dead, open carry.
Jay, thanks for the call. Joe, you were...
No, as you mentioned before, open carry is very much alive because it was in this other bill too. As Marshall pointed out, there were some provisions that were in both bills. The nullification bill died, but this other bill lived, and it's now going to be up to the governor. But even if he vetoes it, there was a majority in the House and Senate that could override it. And there will be a provision. One of the proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot in the fall does deal with gun rights. It's sort of generally worded, But the aim is to just say that we're definitely Second Amendment and we are against anything that is considered as curbing that.
It's an inalienable right, I think, is the way it's likely to be worded.
But with no actual penalties listed for, say, trying to enforce federal gun law.
Dale, you wanted to add something?
I just remember that after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, there was a suggestion here, I think by Tim Fitch, who was the St. Louis County Police Chief, that maybe giving teachers guns would be a good way to kind of stave off something like this. And Governor Nixon came out very strongly at that time saying that guns and teachers just don't mix. And I don't know that his opinion would have changed any time now, but that's certainly going to be a consideration when he's deciding whether or not to sign the bill.
Sure. Terry, let me turn to you to start this one. We only have a couple of minutes left, and we have to talk about an issue that we talk about every year, and that's tax credit reform. No success this time in doing that.
Not only no success, but as Joe and Marshall have already mentioned, $500 million added on in the last day of the session. So there's still no caps on or high caps on many of the tax credits, which is an open hole then in the state budget, threatening, again, revenues for bread and butter services like education, mental health, corrections.
Thoughts on that, Joe and Marshall?
Joe, go ahead. Rex Singfeld's group and some other of his allies are also against tax credits. So especially with this tax breaks that were approved, in theory, you might see that they may actually back more of a move to get rid of some of these tax breaks. But as the last day of session proved, even conservatives who say they're opposed to some of this, when push comes to shove, they put more of it on. So I think it'll be rough to get rid of these tax breaks.
And also, I know that Rex Singfeld may not like some tax credits, but as far as scholarship tax credits, he'd like to see those as a way of getting more opportunity for some students. I attended a forum that was sponsored by the Show Me Institute, which is backed by Mr. Singfeld, and they made the tax credit scholarships a big part of that discussion. Basically, you would give money to a scholarship foundation that would then turn around and give the money to families. The money would never go through government hands. So everybody thinks that this would be legal as far as whatever laws there are against giving any public money to private education.
I'd like to bring in one more call as time will allow here. Melissa in St. Louis, but it'll have to be quick, Melissa.
Yes, I'm just wondering if someone can quickly address the part of the gun bill that passed regarding having school protection officers and guns in schools, but parents would be barred from actually knowing if there would be guns in the school or a school protection officer. And I'll take my answer off the air.
And we've got about a minute and a half to answer it. Rick, Marshall, or Joe?
Well, the bill does stipulate that school districts are supposed to have public hearings to explain that they're going to be doing this, but they don't have to identify who's carrying.
I wish we had time. Had more time, I'd like to have gotten to the issue of ethics and campaign reform. These issues were deep-sixed during the course of the legislative session. In the minute or so we have left, I know everybody knew Rory Ellinger, who passed away during this session, and saddened everyone, regardless of political affiliation. Very quickly, thought about Rory, Terry Jones.
A tremendous public servant. Sympathies to Linda Locke, his wife. He demonstrated what public service was all about and continued to do so till the day he died.
There was one measure of bipartisanship that came out of this year's session, and that was passing Rory Ellinger's bill just days before he passed away. Both parties, both chambers rallied to get that out and get to the governor.
You had to do with breastfeeding, correct?
Yes, the breastfeeding in public, yes.
Yeah. I was there the last week, and he was one of the people who I enjoyed meeting because he always had a cheery face, even when he was upset about something. And he was one of those legislators that both parties respected because he really cared about what he was doing.
Well, yeah, he's missed by all of us. He was a frequent contributor to this program as well. We look forward always to his telephone calls. A final thought very quickly. We have a minute left, less than a minute left.
Well, as far as education goes, we haven't talked about Normandy, but Normandy's future is hanging in the balance now. The task force that the state set up to recommend what should happen to it gave its recommendations to the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education last week. The commissioner, Chris Nicastro, is supposed to make her presentation to the state board tomorrow. There's a small section in the transfer bill that basically says you can't You can't lapse Normandy if it's for only the reason that it's running out of money. We'll have to see what happens.
We'll be talking about that, I'm sure. I want to thank you all, Terry Jones, Dale Singer, Marshall Griffin, Joe Manis, for being with us. Most informative indeed. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the importance of having a good elevator speech and how to create one. Then we'll talk to author and journalist Alan Weissman about his new book, exploring how much longer the world can sustain its growing population and his ideas about dealing with population pressures. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.